at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with writer and poet Luis Alberto Urrea about his recent novel. It's titled The Hummingbird's Daughter. He teaches creative writing at the University of Chicago. The book came out earlier this spring. The story is set in Mexico in the late 1800s, and it's all about a girl named Teresa. Her mother was a poor Indian, barely a girl herself when she gives birth to Teresa. Her father was a rich landowner. Teresa shows a talent for healing and, when she is still quite young, becomes a midwife. Then she has a brush with death, and it leaves her with a mysterious power to heal that she says comes from God, a power to heal just with her touch. Some people call her a saint, but the government of Mexico sees her as a dangerous revolutionary. The book has been very well received. It's been out now for a couple of months. If you're interested in reading the book, you certainly should head down to the bookstore and look for it. It's published by Little Brown. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. He has written a number of books, has published poetry. He's the author of one other book I want to mention in particular, a book titled The Devil's Highway, which was a national bestseller and also a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction. He's the recipient of a number of awards, including an American Book Award and the Lannan Award for Nonfiction. He's also been inducted into the Latino Literary Hall of Fame. His poetry has been collected in the Best American Poetry. His most recent book, Six Kinds of Sky, won the 2002 Forward Magazine Book of the Year Award, the Editor's Choice for Fiction. And as I mentioned, he teaches creative writing at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Not only is The Hummingbird's Daughter a story of some grand sweeping themes like revolution, it's also a family story, and as it happens, it is the story of his family. All of the main characters in this story and many of the events actually happened, and we'll talk about them this morning in this part of the show. Questions, of course, are welcome, as always. 333-9455 is our number here in Champaign-Urbana. But if you would happen to be listening in Chicago, for example, or around Illinois or Indiana, and it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Professor Urrea, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
As I've read a number of articles about the book and little interviews with you, I think in many places that you've said in one way or another that this was a story that you had been wanting to tell and, in fact, researching for a long time.
Yeah, a long, long time. I always tell people that I researched it for 20 years, but in reality, I've probably lived with it my whole life. You know, I mean, I first heard stories about her when I was a child. We would have family gatherings in Tijuana, you know, and I always tell the story when I'm on tour that I had this aunt that we called La Flaca, and she was a very a wild woman, very strong character, and she was blind in one eye and a chain smoker and wore sort of late 50s cat eye glasses, and she would gather us in the dark on Christmas nights and was illuminated only by a kerosene heater in the middle of the room when these sort of lurid orange glow, and she would tell us these tales with her wild eye looking off in the distance. And one of the tales was that we had a Yaqui aunt who was a saint and who could fly and heal the sick and raise the dead, you know. And at the time I thought, well, that's really great, but I didn't really believe it. You know, it was part of a very elaborate lore that my family had to offer at all times. You know, there was a story for everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've learned touring around the country so much that almost everybody, at least with some semi-rural roots, has great histories of these wild stories, no matter what your culture is, you know, of the conjure man or the healer woman or the root worker or the midwife. You know, there's always an ancestor that had these kind of earth skills. So she was mine, and I didn't know she was real until probably 1978 or 9, when I was working as a bilingual TA at a community college, and one of the professors I was working with happened to recognize my name and put two and two together and showed me a book with an article about her. And up to that moment, I hadn't known she was an actual historical figure, and I was absolutely stunned that somebody had written something about her.
Mm. And you, so then you actually went and did research, found out that there had been some things written about her. There had
right.
been newspaper articles. There had been a book. So as I said, when I was trying to do a brief introduction, if you take a look at the story, and on your website, in fact, you have the story there, you can, and if you've read the book, you can see that the main characters, Teresa and her father and the medicine woman, Huila, and
yes.
Lauro Aguirre, and all of the people in there and the things that happened in that book apparently actually happened. There
Absolutely.
Was a real Teresa of Cabora, and all of these things that were attributed to her did indeed happen.
They did. Yeah. It's kind of funny because, you know, the critical response has been, of course, delightful on my end. I'm always happy to get good reviews and not bad reviews, but they keep making a point that it's a magic realist epic, and I always think that's odd, since the really peculiar material in the book, what one would identify as magical, is the actual historical witnessed stuff. And most of the imagined stuff is the sort of daily, you know, dull material. What did they eat and what did they wear? But the actual events in the book are pretty much a straight record of what happened to her, and you know, some of her development and so forth, and certain aspects of it, the details of her training were things that don't exist in any record, you know, partially I think because Mexico, although they claim not to be, is a kind of a racist society, certainly, you know, slanted against its indigenous people in a lot of ways. And so her indigenous upbringing and, you know, her female training have been glossed over by historians. So that sort of training period material in the novel actually came from medicine women who took me in and tried to teach me so I could give an accurate portrait of their work. So in that sense, I feel like it's pretty close to what she probably did experience in training.
There's a character that is important in the book whose influence is felt, although he doesn't really appear directly, and I'm thinking of Porfirio Diaz.
Yeah.
And perhaps as a way of establishing a kind of context for the story, you could talk a little bit about what was going on in Mexico at this point around the turn of the last century, so it's late 1800s, early 1900s.
Right. Well, you know, Diaz was the classic Latin American dictator. You know, he was, you know, Garcia Marquez could have written, you know, any one of his dictator books about this man. He was he was indigenous himself with indigenous roots, but was an iron-handed, strong man who at the time was involved in a great kind of land grab in the north of Mexico, and he was, you know, really trying to establish Mexico as a world power, as an economic power, you know, trying to copy what had happened in the United States with Manifest Destiny in a lot of ways. And so at the time of Teresita, he was involved in a very brutal campaign of land grabbing against the Yaqui people and some of the related tribes around them, and they were you know, taking people off their land. They were sending them to concentration camps. They were transporting tribal people in train cars. It's very reminiscent of awful things that happened in Europe later.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the dispossessed were sent to Quintana Roo and Yucatan to work on plantations, and it was so brutal what was happening to the people that they actually had schedules that had worked out how long it would take to work a person to death. And the standard life expectancy after you were captured by the army and taken off your land was 6 weeks. 6 weeks from capture to death. So they kept a pretty strong flow of human bodies going into southern Mexico to these plantations. And the lands were then sold or given to Europeans and North Americans who, you know, came in and started mining operations, ranching and farming operations and so forth. And there was quite a strong push toward revolution beginning even then. Eladio Aguirre was one of the men who was an early imaginer of revolution. And I think he wanted to be seen as the father of the Mexican Revolution. And one of the small tragedies, I think, in his life is that he was sort of bypassed by history. He didn't get to be a main player in the in the big revolution, but he certainly helped foment it. And Teresita was sort of accidentally cast into this role of revolutionary leader, in that she, because of her miraculous acts and her preaching, had attracted so many indigenous people that she was seen as being the spearhead of a movement that was quite dangerous to the power.
Our guest, Luis Alberto Urrea, he teaches creative writing at University of Illinois in Chicago. We're talking about his recent novel. It's titled The Hummingbird's Daughter. It's published by Little Brown. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. It's this sort of political atmosphere that sets the story in motion when Teresita and Huila and Teresita's father, Don Tomas, who is a rancher in Sinaloa, which is one of the states in Mexico that's on the coast, it's on the ocean, on the Pacific side.
Right.
He ends up backing a local politician who is an anti-Diaz
right.
politician. He loses, so Tomas decides to avoid any possibility of reprisals to uproot everybody. And they move to Sonora, to north, which is, and that's a state that of Mexico and northern Mexico that borders on Arizona. So here, this is an enormous enormous change, a very difficult journey, and a total change of ecosystem because they're moving to the desert. Talk a little bit, perhaps you can talk a little bit about the difference between those two places, between Sinaloa and Sonora.
Right. Well, you know, Sinaloa is a really interesting spot because right about where they were living in Sinaloa is the Tropic of Cancer. So, you know, you can project what the landscape is like. It's the northern end of some pretty rich subtropical landscape. So they were living, you know, almost in the buffer zone between a more arid southwestern landscape and subtropical jungly stuff, which can be found in the south of Sinaloa. So they were used to mango groves and, you know, sugarcane fields and swamps and estuaries and all that sort of thing. But they also had cactus and so forth. But when they went north, they entered into this, what to them was the wasteland, you know, the apocalyptic deserts where they were very afraid to go, the home of the Apache, who was a dedicated and ferocious enemy of the Mexican. So, you know, I mean, the Apaches had recently run a raid all the way from Sonora down to Mazatlan, one of our current, you know, happy playgrounds, burning cities and towns. So people were quite terrified to go north into this land. They didn't know what they were going to find. And, you know, I make a little fun of it, you know, the difficulties with dry air after having been moist all their lives, things like that. But, you know, it was really a strange and frightening transformation for them. And, you know, it's important to know that before the Mexican Revolution, you know, the average Mexican citizen had never traveled very far at all. In fact, most Mexicans had never been over 100 miles from wherever their home was. And so, you know, these were some of the first great adventurers in a way. And it was because of Tomas who led this mad exodus, you know, to safety, because Sonora was a more welcoming area. He was not in political trouble there. And one of the interesting little historical sidelights about him is that he was the first, supposedly, according to the record, one of the first men to introduce domesticated bees to the state of Sonora.
Hmm. At the beginning of the book, we meet Teresa's mother. Her name is Cayetana.
And Cayetana Chavez.
She's just a girl herself.
Right.
And she is carrying the child of the patron, Don Tomas.
Right.
And in at some point, he discovers that, realizes that Teresita is, in fact, his daughter. And she gives birth to the child and fairly soon after that leaves the story, turns the baby over to her sister, who abuses her until she's taken under the wing of Huila, who
right.
recognizes some power in Teresa. And it is her Teresa's mother's who... Her nickname is the Hummingbird. That's right. Where the title of the book comes from. Is there some sort of symbolic significance, or what is the symbolic significance of the Hummingbird? Because the Hummingbird continues to turn up in the story.
Well, the Hummingbird is quite sacred. One of the roundabout things that I can tell you to explain some of the book is that in 1995, I went down to the Tucson area to be closer to the Yaqui people and to try to learn some things on the ground and not just out of books. And I was lucky enough to encounter two branches of my family that I didn't know before I went to Tucson. I didn't even know they were there. And one branch was Apache, and one branch was Yaqui and Mayo, who was the related tribe to the Yaquis. And in that family, I had a cousin who was a healer woman. And so she started teaching me and training me. Oh, sorry, there goes the dog. In her training with me, she started telling me more and more about the hummingbird. And the hummingbird is important in that tradition for a lot of reasons. If you look at sort of indigenous desert metaphor, you can see some of the animals taking the place of some of the other animals that we might find in the Bible, for example. And I would say that the hummingbird sometimes takes the place of what we... You know, in Judeo-Christian cultures, talk about with doves. The hummingbird is a messenger of grace. The hummingbird carries prayers and messages to God and carries prayers and messages back from God, often appears in dreams, giving you symbolic objects. Sometimes appears in the real world at cardinal points in your life, sometimes actually leads the way down a path. Very interesting bird, and it's a very interesting sort of folkloric lifeway position he holds with some of these desert tribes, Tehuecos, Wasavis, Pima, a lot of the people. So I tried to just pay attention to the hummingbird's position in the world that she would have lived in. Which is where that came from. So the hummingbird's daughter, certainly on the most obvious level, she's the daughter of Cayetana Chavez, but on a deeper level, she's sort of the daughter of grace.
She, Teresa, says after this event happens in her life, she has this brush with death. And I don't want to say too much. You know, I don't want to give so much of the story away that people will say, well, I don't need to read it now.
Oh, yeah.
I've heard the show.
Right.
She has this brush with death.
Right.
And then her, before she had this reputation of being able to heal in the folk in the tradition of folk medicine, and she becomes a midwife, and even though she is very young, women who are about to give birth want to have her there. She seems to have a power to take their pain away. And then after this happens, after this event happens in the book, then it seems that she and even she comes into an even greater power, although she is very careful to say that she's not the one who's doing it.
Right.
That she feels that this is something that God is doing, and that she is merely the conduit. That's all. And in fact, she, even though that there's this talk of her being a saint, she herself in the book and also the real Teresita never said that she was a saint.
No, in fact, she fought against being called a saint. She always insisted, I'm just a woman. I'm just a woman. I just had this experience. And, you know, what her take was in her near-death experience is that she had met God and that God had given her a gift to bring back to his children. And that she was not to profit from it, but to give it freely.
What I think interests me is that this is again one of those she as a figure is one of those examples of how different faith traditions end up getting blurred and mixed up.
Yes,
because she is in part embracing Roman Catholicism, but also is grounded in the indigenous religious traditions, and it's a little bit difficult to know exactly where she stands. Maybe it is, pardon the cliche, she's got one foot in each world.
Yeah. Well, I think You know, that's partially a product of the place and the time. You know, those Cajita-speaking tribes, like Yaqui people, they were syncretistic. You know, they had an actual blend of Catholicism and indigenous faith. So I think that was part of what made her philosophical pattern, you know, what helped develop it. She was certainly brought up in an atmosphere where both things were equal in her mind and practice. But on the other hand, you know, she was also the ultimate flowering of Teresita mania that happened was rather apocalyptic and millenarian, and it was a very close in time to Wovoka and the ghost dancers north. And you know, if you study Wovoka, he too was Christianized. So I think it was a way to try to forge a new world version of Christianity. And she was actually quite vocal in her criticism of Rome and the Roman Catholic Church because they, in her opinion, supported power over the rights of people.
And there is this, it just now makes me think of the man, there was a leader of one of the people who lived in the area who called himself the Pope of Mexico.
Cruz Chavez, yeah, he was the Pope of Mexico, that's true.
And so there actually was such a person?
Oh, yeah, Cruz Chavez. In fact, Paul Vanderwood, the historian from California, has a wonderful book about Cruz Chavez and the Tomochic Rebellion, which is called God and Guns Against the Great Power of Government. And, you know, he was a real guy, and it was a real massacre. You know, the Mexican army annihilated the town for following Teresita, essentially, and they massacred 300 people, which, again, is an eerie echo of what happened at Wounded Knee with the ghost dancers. So it's a very interesting, sort of a mirror history of indigenous warfare.
In the book, one of the kind of debates or struggles, I guess, that rages is over spirituality, and there is a great debate, particularly between Teresa and her father,
yeah,
about religion and about the church, because her father is a serious non-believer, and who sort of thinks that it's all bunk. And she is a person who is very much a person of the spirit, and she feels that she's talked to God. So she obviously believes. I wonder, did you enjoy putting yourself in both and on having to take up both sides of that debate?
Oh yeah, it was a riot. Yeah, as a writer, it was a lot of fun. I mean, in some ways the book is about her dad more than anything, I think, because you know much of the story, though it focuses on her and her training and her spirit, a lot of the story is about Tomas's own struggle. I mean, he wants to believe. He wouldn't mind believing, but he's a rationalist too. He's a reasonable man, and he just can't find a philosophical or scientific or rational explanation for all this stuff. You know, yet he stands beside her with surprising loyalty. And, you know, he's a man who I think surprised himself and everybody around him over and over again. He, all through the story, you know, he's asked to make these tremendous sacrifices and these tremendous leaps, and he does so. Hmm. And I think, you know, I get this strong feeling from him that he was often sitting in a dark room with a snifter of brandy thinking, what the hell is happening? You know, because when the pilgrimages began, when her fanatics started showing up, they destroyed everything he had worked to create. They destroyed the ranch. They ruined everything. And then suddenly they were, you know, he and his daughter are cast out. I mean, when you think about what he lost, it's overwhelming. Yet he really did stand beside her. And at the moment when the Mexican army was going to kill her, he really did put himself between their weapons and her body and said, basically shoot her through me then. Hmm. And they didn't want to shoot him. They, you know, it's part of the reasons she was spared.
One of the stories that you tell in early on is, we were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that the family is uprooted and moves for because of politics and moves to Sonora. And when they get there to this Urrea family property there in Cabora, the place is just almost before they got there has been raided by the Yaquis who live in the neighborhood.
Right.
And he sets out to, by himself, to go and talk with them and goes and works out a deal, makes peace, gets back the people who were captured, and works out a peaceful, neighborly relationship with the Yaquis. That
right.
happens in the novel. That actually happened. Don Tomas actually did that.
Yeah, it does. That's one of those, you know, dances with wolves fantasies, right, where I go to the warriors and make them my pals. But mm-hmm. he really did do it. And he was under, you can imagine, in the environment in which they lived, in the situations that were going on, he could have very easily turned back to the government and ingratiated himself immediately by saying, you know, the savages have attacked, let us go forth and annihilate them. And they would have destroyed the village, or his cowboys would have done it. Instead, he chose to go and face them. And they're conflicting. I mean, you know, you have to cobble the story together from a lot of sources. And some of them say he may have taken a couple of cowboys. Some of them said he went alone. I preferred, for the story's sake, that he go alone. And I, you know, I believe he would have if, you know, if he did take cowboys, he took one or two. But I believe he probably did go by himself. But he went and found the village that was responsible for the attack and talked to the elders. And it so impressed them that this man would come out there and face them, that they showed mercy to him. Mm. And when they explained why, that they were starving, they were being exterminated by the government, they had nowhere to turn, they thought they were at war with him too, then he extended mercy to them in return and said, you know, I will dedicate 10% of all of our produce every year, including our cattle, to you, so you will not go hungry again. And, you know, he struck up a peace accord of his own, and he made his lands, you know, safe ground for Yaqui people not to be killed and hunted. So I think that's the moment in which he really grows up. He's faced all these things, and many of his adventures are sort of comedic and absurd, including having to flee Sinaloa. But suddenly he's confronted with a very serious life or death issue, and I think he chooses life, and I'll always respect him for that.
Well, and one for him, I think clearly, at least the character that you present in the story, his riding out alone was a great moment of liberation for him, of the kind of freedom that he experiences. Is something that he finds truly exhilarating.
Right. I think it liberates him, and in some ways ruins him too, because he realizes after this long, lonesome journey, facing dangers and being completely free of all the constraints around him, that forevermore he will feel trapped, because, you know, he will have to be the patron. He can't just be the wandering adventurer. He's going to have to buckle down. But he has that one intoxicating taste of freedom and self-reliance, and it means everything to him. And I think it gives him the kind of strength to face the strange events that are about to befall him.
Well, let me just introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Luis Alberto Urrea. He teaches creative writing at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's a poet. He's the author of the book The Devil's Highway, which is a nonfiction work. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction for that book. And in fact, he discussed that book on our Afternoon Magazine program not very long ago. And in fact, if people want to hear the interview, if they'll go to our web archive, WILL.UIUC.EDU. You can hear that interview, and you can look for the book as well as his novel, The Hummingbird's Daughter. It's published by Little Brown and should certainly be in the bookstores right now. Going back to, you talked about what happened after Teresa has her near-death experience and now demonstrates this remarkable healing ability, that people, thousands of people, come to the ranch and literally camp out there waiting to be able to see her. And as you say, the place is just destroyed, and poor Don Tomas doesn't really know quite what to do, although he loves his daughter very much, and at some level he must recognize her her power. So he certainly doesn't chase all these people away, but it completely destroys the place and ultimately causes them so much trouble that they're exiled to, of all places, the United States. And again, that this is another. I know I keep sort of saying this, but again, this is something that actually happened to Teresa.
It did happen. She attracted such fervent believers and followers that, you know, people came from everywhere, and there were many reporters there. So I was startled once I, you know, got deeply into the archives and things to keep finding eyewitness accounts and reporters' accounts. And there's a story in the novel about a man who is overheard in the crowd saying, "She's no saint. Any woman that uses the bathroom, you know, is not a saint. And any woman who eats food like me, she's no saint." And the next day she calls the man forward and says, "You know, as far as eating goes, I eat mostly fruit and vegetable. And as far as the bathroom goes, there's nothing I can do about that. But your wife is cheating on you, and she and her lover are waiting to kill you at home." That story, which I thought was wonderful and amusing, was actually collected by a brother of mine who in the 80s went into Sonora and interviewed for me on tape a 101-year-old curandera who was blind and about to die, who had watched things, you know, eyewitness at the camp. And no other historian ever got that story. I'm the only one that got it. So I was really thrilled, of course, to put that in the book. But every one of those kind of events is I tried to keep to the record so that, you know, that they're fanciful enough even as historical record, you know. But they allegedly happened.
She comes to the attention of the Mexican government because, in part, because she attracts all of these people, but
right.
Also because, in addition to doing healing, she's got a political message.
She does,
where she's essentially telling people that the way that they have been treated is wrong, that they have been victims of a terrible injustice, and that certainly was a very, very dangerous message.
It was. And, you know, part of her message was fairly simple, which was God gave a particular land to particular people. This land was given to you. No one should take it away from you. Now, you know, when you tell a warrior people that, that translates pretty quickly into, well, let's fight for it. And, you know, then she tried to do damage control later by saying, don't fight. I harm no one. But of course, you know, it was a fuse waiting to be lit. And the Mexican government knew perfectly well that if that fuse got lit, there would be terrible trouble. They'd already had war upon war, and they were engaged in a war with the Apaches. They had had, you know, wars with the Opata tribes. And so they themselves were trying to nip it in the bud. And they initially wanted to execute her. But they realized if they executed her, the wildfire would be worse. And that's how she was, you know, the next worst thing Diaz could think to do was send her to the United States.
This was, as people will remember, this was the man who, it is said, that immortal comment was said to have said, "Poor Mexico, so far from God, so close to the United States."
That's right. So close to the United States. So he puts her on a train. And, you know, that they were expecting the Indian warriors to attack the train. So in some ways, you know, if you look at it, it was a really amazing bit of political chicanery, thinking, well, let's let them kill them herself, you know, kill her themselves. Mm-hmm. But she stopped this attack. And, you know, the whole sort of climactic scene in the book, which I don't want to give too much away, I guess, but there's a very slight mention that I saw in one of the histories that just gave me chills, and that was that she was going through a canyon on this train, and the warriors, instead of attacking, stood along the tracks and held their weapons over their heads as she passed. And I thought, oh my God, that's just incredible. You know, it's hard to, when you go to the Mexican histories of this stuff, you know, you find these historians over and over again saying just outrageous, you know, sort of woman-hating commentary, which is really interesting to see. And people like Wheela, for example, her very important teacher, who was not only female but indigenous, is completely erased. Hmm. But Teresita is, you know, condescendingly written about, that she's a hysterical female, that the saintliness was due to menstrual hysteria. You know, so I always tell people on tour that it seems to me that if you believe Mexican historians, this entire book is, an episode of PMS. You know, and that's just, it's just awful, because it's such a huge history and it's such an important history, then it's just gone. Mm. It's disappeared unless you really, really dig. And I was doing it really at first as just a hobby, as a gift to my own family to say, look, this is her story. You know, that's really how it started, just trying to gather the information for the family.
What was the position of the Catholic Church on this quote-unquote saint?
Big thumbs down on the saint of Cabora. They were not thrilled. Part of the catastrophe that befell her was circuit riding priests who basically sent reports about her. There are allegedly some reports in the Vatican archives from the field about her evil behavior, which I would love to find out, but I don't think the Vatican's that forthcoming with things like that. Though I have a historian acquaintance who was trying at one time to get in their archives and find the reports. But one of the things that happened to her historically was that the priest Father Gastelum, who sort of had the circuit of northern Mexico in that Sierra region, saw the Pope of Mexico's church, which was already in some trouble because they had, of course, claimed that they were the popes, not the Pope, that they were worshiping with statues of her in the church, which he considered a heresy. So essentially what happened was the military regional officer, you know, who was sort of in charge of that part of the desert where the ranch was, sent a message to President Diaz in Mexico City that this girl was fomenting Yaqui unrest and preaching a kind of a secession thing. At the same time, the priest sent a report which was forwarded to Mexico City. So unfortunately for everybody, the reports arrived at the same time. And you can imagine Porfirio Diaz, you know, in the same week hearing that not here she is in Sonora fomenting Yaqui revolution, but her followers in Chihuahua are arming themselves and beginning. He's thinking, you know, my God, I'm losing the entire north because of this girl. She was only 19 years old. So he decided, I'm going to squash this immediately and silence her.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Luis Alberto Urrea. He's professor at University of Illinois Chicago, professor of English, where he teaches creative writing. The book we're talking about is The Hummingbird's Daughter. It's published by Little Brown. It's been out now just a couple of months, and you should find it in the bookstore, and it's a great story. If you'd like to talk with us, by the way, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just the real Teresita, how significant was she in prompting the Mexican Revolution?
You know, it's hard to say. When she left and came to the United States, I think in some ways she may have had a larger role than when she was in Mexico, in that she began writing editorials and writing broadsides and so forth. Lauro Aguirre certainly wanted to turn her into an engine of revolt. But she wrote some pretty inflammatory stuff, just citing the numbers and the details of what the atrocities against the Yaqui people were. And her followers, you know, invaded the United States. They came in from Sonora and invaded Nogales, Arizona, and they blew up the customs house. And again, in an eerie kind of echo of the ghost dancers at Pine Ridge Reservation, they didn't have ghost shirts that would stop bullets, but they had pictures of her that they thought would stop bullets. And they found out, to everyone's horror, that they didn't, in fact, stop bullets. And they were shot down in the streets of Nogales. There are famous pictures of them lined up dead on the sidewalk, you know. So that certainly was one of the, again, a fuse lighter. But, you know, Diaz was also smart in that, having sent her to the United States, I think he suspected that wild, industrially hatching America would consume her. And it ultimately did. You know, she began a very American version of this story. You know, and she originally was living outside of Tucson, and then Tomas moved her to El Paso, and the flocks followed her, so he dragged her up into the mountains to the Clifton Morenci area where they got established, and some family drama ensued, and she ended up leaving Clifton Morenci in some state of shame and went to San Jose, California, where she, you know, commenced her healing and began this wild American journey that took her to L.A. She lived in St. Louis. She lived in Manhattan in a brownstone on 9th. She had children there. You know, she became a Gibson girl and won a beauty competition along the way. And you start to really see in her American life this yearning beneath all of the saintliness to just be a normal young woman just once. You know, let me get fixed up once. Let me have my hair done and dress nicely just once. Let me be in love and be a mother. You know, and so in that sense, her story, I think, is kind of a tragedy, even though it's funny. And there's a lot of joy in it. I also think there's a lot of sorrow in it for her.
Yeah. And just when you look at the details of your life, if you had written that, people would say, I think you're pushing it a little bit.
Yeah.
But one thing that just really strikes me in reading her real story that you have on your website is that she apparently was reunited with her mother on
yeah.
her deathbed.
Can you believe that?
She was dying, and mom comes to the door after all this time.
I know. You know, I've signed the contract to write the sequel, and, you know, on some level, I feel like I should be writing an opera instead because everything is so grand in this story. But, yeah, it's like the story closes down the way it begins. You know, the mother has her and disappears, literally disappeared. Nobody knew whatever happened to her. At the end of Teresita's life, she died when she was 33. She's on her deathbed with consumption, going to die, and she says to everybody, wait, I can't go yet. And lo and behold, out of the blue, for no reason, with no explanation, Cayetana appears. Nobody knows how. Nobody knows what in the world summoned her. She appears and goes in the room with Teresita, and they spend a day laughing and talking and holding hands and crying and all this sort of thing. And then Teresita calls everybody in that evening and says, I can sleep now, and dies. And it just is one of those things that is, you know, it's too rich, but it's true.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, here we go.
We do have a caller here and about 10 minutes left. And if other folks would like to call in and ask questions, you can do that. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The caller is in Indiana on our toll free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. In some ways, it's beyond opera. There's no question about that. I was dilly-dallying around because it's so interesting. I didn't know if I want to take up the time to ask a question. That's a lot of times that's the way with David's shows. You know, you're just sort of like hanging on the edge of your seat and thinking what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
But, you know, to bring it back down to academic reality in some sense, the question about having photographs of her thinking they may stop bullets and then
yes.
the previous fellow talking about, well, that's no saint, you know.
Yes.
I guess saints aren't supposed to go to the bathroom or wear
right.
those kinds of clothes. I just wonder if you can make a comment about that in a general sense. When they were shot and photographs were taken, and I presume the other peoples would know about that, did that lessen the admiration or the, you know, since
it,
quote unquote,
it did.
The divinity?
I noticed, talking interestingly enough to a reporter for the Los Angeles Times who's actually quite an expert on Mexican folk saints, we realize that the folk saints are almost exclusively male, and we couldn't come up with a female folk saint like Teresita, except for Teresita, that's really lasted and is surging. And it's interesting that aspects of regular humanity and womanhood with her diminished people's fervor. In fact, when she finally settled down and had her own children, on a very real level, she wasn't forgiven by the people. Yeah. It was almost like, you know, wait a minute, how dare you not be a virgin? You know, how dare you not be a Madonna?
Yeah.
And again, she kept insisting, I'm just a person. I'm just a woman, you know, trying to pass on this thing. It works through me. I don't do it. And she wanted a real life. She wanted a family. So, yeah, I think she was, on some level, not forgiven. And also, concurrently, which I think is really interesting, as people sort of lost their passion for her and their faith in her, her own gifts apparently diminished. And near the end of her life, she actually opened a clinic that started practicing Western medicine because she said that she was just tired and her gifts had faded. So, you know, there's something about the two feeding each other.
Yeah.
You know, the flame of the people's faith and passion for this thing certainly, I think, seemed to inspire whatever heights she could reach.
Yeah.
You know, so it's up for, I mean, on the rational side, on the Tomas side, you know, you can really make a case for it being perhaps some kind of hypnotism or mesmerism. Reiki healers are very interested in her because, you know, in my research I found, for example, that she didn't actually touch people, but apparently would hold her hands near them.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, I don't know much about Reiki, but Reiki people apparently do this kind of healing with, you know, the field of whatever around the body. So I really, you know, I have taken it as an item of faith that she really did the healings, but I don't know what the engine was that drove them. It might have just been the passion. You know, if you believed strongly enough, perhaps, you know, an amazing thing happened to you. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess we got a few decades to go before that all gets worked out. But I'm there with you on that. You know, I went through an extremely rational stage in college and stuff, and things do happen that, you know, if it's not, I don't call it, you know, super rational, but there's something going on there, and she's an incredible woman, there's no question about that. And when you mentioned about being a Gibson girl, I about fell off my chair.
Oh, yeah, in fact, you know,
it's remarkable.
We've put together a pretty good gallery now of pictures of her and her dad and Laudo and stuff, so I'm going to start putting those up on my website. And I just wanted to say about the rational stuff, you know, when I first started working on this book, I often tell this story, but I was friends with Linda Hogan. I don't know if you know her, the Native American writer and poet. And I went and I spent about 2 hours telling her the whole story. And I tried to weasel out of writing it. I kept saying, why don't you write this story? And she'd say, no, it's your aunt. You write it. And I said, I don't think I can get my Western mind around the details of this story. And she said, honey, the Western mind is a fever. It will pass. And, you know, I've got to tell you that some of the weird stuff that happened to me working on this, especially when I began studying with actual shaman-type people, changed me forever.
Yep.
And, you know, my editor and I often joke that I should write a book about what happened writing the book, because that was very strange.
Sounds like, you know, certainly should be. People want to be reading it. There's no question about that. It first thing that came across my mind when I sort of summing this up near the end here was that this lady, you know, just screams to be, your book just screams to be in a, you know, some high school class where they're, you know, doing, you know, different cultures and women's issues and stuff because she's awful remarkable. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Thank you so much.
All right. We'll try real quick to squeeze one more. Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. You mentioned that there are few women folk saints, but there are in Mexican culture these sort of archetypal figures. I was thinking also the crying one, the wailing one.
Yeah, La Llorona, yeah.
Yeah, and it seems to me that there's this, that I saw that simile there, and then I was wondering where that, you know, how this culturally comes about. You were talking about juxtaposing Wounded Knee and in this instance, in sort of the colonial indigenous reaction kind of thing. And there seems to be a structural thing going on there as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think part of it was this kind of millennium fever happening, you know, where there was a great change coming on, that there was a century change coming, and people were really hoping, almost against hope, that the world would be restored to them somehow, you know, and I guess in some ways it was their version of the rapture that so fascinates people now, you know, thinking that we're all going to be plucked away and whatever's going to happen and the world will be remade. But, you know, people were hoping so much that the dead would come back, that the land would be restored to them, that they could just go back to their lives, that they didn't know what had happened to them. They didn't know what had happened to their world. So I think there's a lot to be said for that. And I'm very interested in that sort of continent-wide kind of convulsion that I think was happening. One of the historians said that at the time of Teresita, those mountains bred messiahs like mushrooms after a rainstorm. And I think it's, you know, partially, again, the passion and the desperation of the people themselves.
We're going to have to stop. My apologies to the caller for jumping in there, but we're simply at the end of the time. And I will again tell you that if you want to read the book, I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore.
It's, oh, yeah.
It's The Hummingbird's Daughter. It's published by Little Brown. And you also might want to look at our guest's earlier book, the one that was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. And this is a nonfiction book, The Devil's Highway, about people trying to come from Mexico to the United States.
Yeah.
And our guest, Luis Alberto Urrea, he teaches creative writing at University of Illinois Chicago. And thanks very much for
Thank
talking
you
with
so
us.
So much.
I thought it was a wonderful book. I enjoyed it
Thank
very much.
You. Good talking to you.
All right. Good talking to you, too. Programming here on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds. It's distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. Programs also made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. We're going to break. In the next hour, we'll be talking about Haiti with an attorney, Thomas Griffin, who spent some time investigating human rights abuses there. First, though, we'll take a break for news and update on the markets. Stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carl Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
On the Chicago Board of Trade at this hour, September wheat at 319.5 is down.